गुफार की जय। नामाचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की जय। प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदार हर श्रीवासानी श्री गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। साम वेद भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 11, The Transcendental Qualities of Vritrasura. This morning is text number 21. Vritrasura is speaking. Aham Samadhaya Mano Yaha Yataha Naha Sankarshanas Tacharanaravinde Tvat Vajra Ramho Lulita Gramya Pasho Gatim Munir Yami Apavidda Lokaha Aham Samadhaya Mano Yatahana Sankarshanastacharanaravinde Vajraramho Lidita Gramya Pasho Gatim Munir Yamya Pravidda Lokah Aham Samadhaya Mano Yatahana Sankarshanastacharanaravinde Vajraramho Lilita Gramya Pasho Gatim Munir Yamya Pravidda Lokah Aham Samadaya Mano Yatahana Sankarshanastacharanaravinde Vajraramho Lalita Gramya Pasho Gatim Munir Yamya Pravidda Lokah
Yam Yapadita Lokah
Aham
samadhaya mano yattaha na.
Aham samadhaya mano yattaha na.
Sankarsanastha charanaravinde.
Sankarsanastha charanaravinde.
Madhragam ho lulita granja paso.
Madhragam ho lulita granja paso.
Patim numirjami apapida lokaha.
Patim numirjami apapida lokaha. Vichasura addressing Indra. By the force of your thunderbolt, I shall be freed of material bondage and shall give up this body and this world of material desires. Fixing my mind upon the lotus feet of Lord Sankarsana, I shall attain the destination of such great sages as Narad Muni, just as Lord Sankarsana has said. Srila Prabhupada's report. The words, Aham Samadaya Manaha, first three words of the text, the words Aham Samadhaya Manaha indicate that the most important duty at the time of death is to concentrate one's mind, if one can fix his mind, on the lotus feet of Krishna, Vishnu, Sankarsana, or any Vishnu Murti, his life will be successful. To be killed while fixing his mind at the lotus feet of Sankarsana, Vidrasura asked Indra to release his Vajra, or thunderbolt. He was destined to be killed by the thunderbolt given by Lord Vishnu. There was no question of its being baffled. Therefore, Vidrasura requested Indra to release the thunderbolt immediately, and he prepared himself by fixing his mind at the lotus feet of Krishna. A devotee is always ready to give up his material body, which is described herein as gramya pasha, the rope of material attachment. The body is not at all good. It is simply a cause of bondage to the material world. Unfortunately, even though the body is destined for destruction, fools and rascals invest all their faith in the body and are never eager to return home back to Godhead. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nivishesha Surya Varipas Chachave Satarane Om Manyanam Timarandasya Gananjana Silakaya Chatsu Umilitam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Pancha Kalpa Prithvyas Chakritva Sindhu Vyeva Chakratitanam Pavane Vyo Vaishnave Vyo Namo Namaha. So this instruction contained by Prabhupada in the purport and the example of Vidrasura becomes every year more and more timely. This is an inevitable fact. The time of death is coming, and we unfortunately live in a civilization in which this is put aside, covered up, put away. Shukadeva Goswami, describing this kind of a civilization, says about these people, Pashyam Pati in the Pashyati. Although it is right in front of their eyes, they don't see it. They see, but they don't see. Well, what we would say today, in psychological terms, is people are in denial. Going on with their merry lives, pretending that this overwhelming fact of death does not exist. And you have to put out a great deal of energy and effort to maintain this illusion. And it is a very unfortunate thing for people, because in order to enjoy in this world, one has to become unconscious. This was pointed out the French philosopher Pascal in one place. He said, concerning human life, he said that people are so necessarily mad, meaning insane. But this is the same word used by Shukadeva Goswami in the Bhagavatam, Pramattaha. People are crazy. They're insane. So Pascal also, people are so, but he called them necessarily mad. Why necessarily mad? He said, because not to be mad is another form of madness. He's saying that if people actually looked at the material world as it actually is, without any blinders, or it would be so horrible. They couldn't stand it. They would go crazy. And so, in order to have a happy life, they necessarily have to pretend that this world is not what it is. So here it's another beautiful day in Marsaloka. Everything is nice, everything is pleasant, the sun is shining, the weather forecast will be nice, we can do so many things to have fun today. There are other bad places, we know about that, Sudan or whatever the latest disaster is happening, where people are dying and it's really miserable. But here, it's nice. But let's take off the blinkers. Let's just see. We can take a 10-mile circle around the Lachua, and let's see how many people are dying. And you go, oh, wow, it's like a war practically. There's literally hundreds, and because of that, so many more who are related to them or attached to them are suffering unimaginable pangs of grief. And so if we opened ourselves up to the sum total of human suffering on this planet at this very minute, if we had any feeling for everybody, it would be unbearable. Because sometimes it happens, somebody near and dear to us is going to leave their body or threatened, and immediately, oh, we feel so horrible. It's terrible that this is happening. And we feel it for this particular person because we have some bodily relationship. But as devotees, we should understand that we're related to people not on the basis of the body, on the soul. And if we're on looking at everybody on the basis of the soul, then we see everybody as our relative. And how should we be feeling? So therefore, Vaishnavas are compassionate. Because they are not deluded. Even though we're in a civilization of systematic delusion based on the body. This purport where Prabhupada said, unfortunately, though the body is destined for destruction, fools and rascals invest all their faith in the body and are never eager to return home back to Godhead. The body is like this. While I was in India recently, this bump started to grow on my arm, and it was growing pretty fast. So when I got back to the States, I went to the doctor, and they took a biopsy, and it came back that it was a squamous cell carcinoma. It's a kind of cancer, not dangerous particularly, unless you forget about it entirely. It doesn't spread really fast. But the guy, the doctor said, I've made an appointment with you with a dermatologist, and they'll confirm what it is and take care of it. So I've never been to a dermatologist in my life. So I made the appointment with the dermatologist, who was in a place called the Skin Smart Dermatology and Aesthetics Center. Now here I'm concerned about cancer, right? And I walk into this thing that I think is a doctor's office, and what it really looks like and feels like is a really high-end beauty parlor, which is what it turns out to be, because you can see by their brochures, their clientele is mostly people concerned about stopping the process of aging by various efforts, and so you could see there that this kind of deep, profound dedication to the skin and bodily beauty. I thought it was just interesting. I was there, dermatologist was actually a very nice young lady. They always looked like they, belong in high school at my age. What are they doing practicing medicine? but anyways, she did her thing and removed it, and but it was quite something to see this sort of contrast of having a potentially serious medical condition and not taking care of in time. In the aesthetics, the temple of bodily beauty there. Prabhupada says here, the body is not at all good. Now, we may say, well, that's an extreme statement. But one should understand this, the profound truth in this. It is not a good deal. Of course, we want to be alive. Just being alive just being conscious is a wonderful thing. We have this desire to be alive, to be happy. And that's natural because it comes from the soul. Our mistake is that we have imposed these desires for the satisfaction of the self onto the material body, which is the wrong place to put it. We have accepted what is the not-self as the self. And because of this investment of trying to think of this body, the self is eternal. I think the body is the self, so I think my body, it actually should be eternal. It really must be. I once had a college girl come and talk to me, sitting in my office, and she said to me, I was trying to talk to her along these lines, you know, the basic principles of Krishna consciousness, and she said, well, I know I'm not going to die. And I said to her, what makes you so sure? She says, I just feel it. She said, I just feel it. I said, well, don't you see around you so many people are dying? She says, yes, but when it becomes an issue for me, I'm sure they will have solved the problem. This is somebody in college, you know. And you look at this and you think, how can anyone be this stupid? And be in college, too. But it's actually, she just was saying what many people deep in their hearts believe. And don't want to appear stupid, so they don't say it. That is called in denial. Actually, if you use some more psychological jargon, it's called narcissism. You know, Narcissus was the Greek god of extraordinarily beauty, or maybe he wasn't a god, maybe he was immortal, but an extraordinary beauty. Yeah, he was, and he. Everyone was so attracted to him. And one day he bent down over a stream to take some, this is the day before mirrors, he bent down before a stream to take a drink of water and saw his reflection and fell in love with his reflection and was just paralyzed by his beauty and so his own beauty. And so then the gods changed him into this flower we call a narcissist. So he's a narcissist. I am so wonderful, I am so special, nothing bad can happen to me. The psychological term for this is narcissism. I'm the center of the universe, somehow there's special care for me. Young people especially have it. One of the reasons why the army needs young people for soldiers. Because it's reported that soldiers going into battle feel sorry for the guys next to them. They're going to get hurt, but somehow they think, I'm so special, it won't happen to me. So this is a characteristic of human beings, and in a certain way, you need it to get along to get along in the world. There was a book written a number of years ago about America called The Culture of Narcissism. So we've taken this, and you can read about the narcissistic personality disorder, you'll see it sort of describes a civilization too. But it's an illusion. Shukadeva Goswami talks to this about this when he's describing, well, he's answering Maharaj Pariksit's question. He says, what is the highest the samsiddhim, the highest perfection that can be achieved in this human birth. Can you tell me what it is? And Sukadeva Goswami said, this is the highest advantage of this human birth, Ante Narayana Smritihi, to be able to fix the mind on Narayana at the end of life. And Maharaj Pariksit particularly had asked it for one who was about to die. He knew that death was coming. Just like Vritrasura knows death is coming. And as Vritrasura and Maharaj Pariksit, they were up for it. They were now preparing to meet death and to deal with it in a proper way. That's the answer to be able to remember Narayana at the end. Aham samadaya manaha indicates the most important duty at the time of death is to concentrate one's mind. If one can fix one mind at the lotus feet of Krishna, Vishnu, and so on, his life will be successful. So Prabhupada is saying the same thing here. How do we judge a successful life? By the bank balance one is left behind, never to be able to make any more withdrawals. We have so many markers of a successful life, and according to this, none of them are the real determinations of success. Success is to be able to remember the lotus feet of the Lord at the time of death. So this is the answer here. Also in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives the same answer. And so we have in the whole Bhagavatam is really the main narrative, the central narrative, is about somebody who has warning of death and is going to try to deal with it properly. We hear and chant about Krishna. The thing is that this requires preparation. And to prepare for this, one has to be free from this illusion about this material body. It is true, it's fun for a little while. And my first advice to anybody who wants to be happy in this world is don't get any older than 18. You can stop time. It's fun for a little while, and then it becomes more and more troublesome. And then all this, the instruments of the body that were the cause of so much pleasure, they become it's themselves the cause of suffering. And if you're young, old age is something that happens to somebody else, won't happen to me, but then one day you wake up, it just seems like yesterday you were young and now you're old. We're getting old and things are beginning to break down. And Prabhupada remarks in the second canto about these people who have blind to this inquiry into the self, who don't really see, who are crazy in this way, that they have got fallible soldiers. The verse calls them atma sanyi sanya. Their spouse, their children, their relatives, their house, their wealth. These are all people enlisted as soldiers. Well, soldier means someone who fights a war. And so Prabhupada says in the purport, the people who want to enjoy in this world have declared war on material nature. They have declared war on time. And we should understand that this is axiomatic, that you should never engage in a war that you're going to lose. And this is a battle that everyone is losing. You cannot fight material nature. You cannot fight time. But we try to do it. So people in this world have their immortality projects going on. And there are all these foolish, silly things that I can say I'm special, I'm wonderful, I'm not going to die. Reproduction is an immortality project itself. Yes, I'm growing old, but look at my little offspring, my little replicas of myself running around, and they're young. And then if I'm a parent who's really depending on them so much, I live through them vicariously, driving them crazy in the process. And wanting them to do better than I did, you know. Oh, it's a terrible thing. But that's one immortality project. And then people want to become famous. That's another. Fame is an immortal, undying fame, everlasting fame. And so it's very important that some character who has served as President of the United States for 4 years nevertheless builds a presidential library where every scrap of incriminating paper from his administration is stored away because future scholars will want to know about them. I mean, what a vanity project that one is, huh? So all the whole world is filled with these various immortality projects that people are engaged in. I'm important. I have a big house. I have a big bank account. I run a business empire. And so they make these are the defenses against death. You know, they want security, right? And therefore, they've got insurance up to the eyeballs. And they've got a house that's got 7 layers of defenses, you know, motion detectors like Bill Gates and everything, and hidden cameras and everything else. But somehow or other, you know, death gets in through all those defenses, and boom, like a little pin, boom, dispatches them. And none of them work. So we need to see this. It's very hard not to be influenced by the predominant culture that we live in. It's the vibe is there of enjoying this world, and one should understand it's a collective delusion, so that people can be hypnotized into denial. The most important fact. If you want to read an interesting fictional account of this state, this is one of the few works of fiction I think I can recommend safely to devotees to read. It's a short story by Tolstoy, a Russian novelist, Tolstoy, called The Death of Ivan Illich. And it's great. Every devotee would. It's about a bourgeois Russian family. The man is some kind of official in the government, and he's got his children and his wife. And he has some kind of household accident and gets hurt, and it gradually becomes clear to him that he's dying. Nobody will discuss it. Nobody will talk about it. Nobody will deal with it. Everybody's just pretending like it's not happening, and he's all isolated. He says, here, this really important thing is happening to me. And the doctor won't tell him, his wife, his children ignore him. He's just an inconvenience. You should read it. Because it's just a perfect description of the life of oblivion. And all these other people think it will not happen to them. Of course, the ending is not as satisfactory as a devotee would want, because there's no Ante Narayana Smriti in Tolstoy's story. So we have to provide the ending. So there's many schools of psychology that say that the problems we deal with in life and our inabilities to really fully live our own lives is due to the aftermath of trauma. Usually they go back and talk about childhood traumas that we haven't dealt with successfully, and therefore they're messing up our lives. Further back than that, Otto Rank, who started out as a student of Sigmund Freud, talked about the birth trauma. He thought of that as a trauma. I don't know whether that's true or not. But as devotees, we should understand what the real trauma is. The trauma is coming into the material world. The trauma is that the loss of sat, apparently to us, coming in the material world, the apparent loss of sat of eternity. Because we are eternal, and our nature is to live in the eternal atmosphere, but suddenly we are in a place where everything is temporary. That's a trauma. The loss of chit. We don't know what the future will bring. We have to find our way in this world, and we don't have enough information. We're always lacking information. We try to find information. It's very difficult. It's frequently wrong, almost always wrong, actually. And yet we have to go ahead. We're always in anxiety. The loss of sat, the loss of chit, and the loss of ananda. Actual happiness is always our nature, but it doesn't come all the time, and what we have to do to get happiness seems to increase misery. Everything we do for happiness actually has the opposite effect in this world. So we're suffering from this trauma, loss of sat, loss of chit, loss of ananda. We have to go back to this, deal with that. And that loss is due to a consequences of turning away from Krishna. Krishna Bahirmukha. Turning away from Krishna. And that's why the remedy is to turn back to Krishna. The remedy is to really fix this. It's traumatic. It's hard for us to deal with because there's a breach in a relationship when we talk about a soul falling in the material world. In religions, there's two kinds of ways of accounting of our situation in this world. One is to talk about it as in terms of ignorance, knowledge and ignorance. It's a loss of knowledge. The impersonalist traditions really stress this. There's just beginningless ignorance. You're ignorant and we have to come into knowledge. Theistic traditions see this as one aspect of something else, which is the breaking of a relationship. It's personal. And therefore, that breaking of a relationship with God is called sin. And therefore, not in terms of knowledge, but of good and evil come into play. That's why people really like to go to the impersonal tradition, because it's they'd rather talk about ignorance and knowledge than good and evil. But actually, the fact is that there was a breaking of a relationship. Now, usually in the material world, when a relationship is broken, you know, there's some marriages having trouble, you go to the marriage counselor, they tell you there's problems on both sides. Both parties are at fault. And let's stop trying to assign the blame and just work on it, and so on. And it's true. In this world, both parties are at fault. But when it comes to the relationship with Krishna, Krishna is actually blameless. Not only is blameless, you cannot find any fault with him. Therefore, I did it. Okay. And if one sees this event of turning away from Krishna in its full aspect, it appears as a crime of such enormity that it's very hard to bear. But ultimately, a devotee has to say, yep, I did it. It's all my fault. I turned away from Krishna. I came into this material world. And now I am very, very sorry. Please accept me back, even though actually I deserve to stay in this world for millions of years. I deserve never to come back. I deserve every punishment, the material energy. There's nothing I don't deserve, but I just want to go back to you. That's the attitude of a devotee. That's actually what heals the trauma. Krishna says that in the material world we're covered by attachment, fear, and anger. And Prabhupada glosses that in one way. One of the angers I've seen in the West is people are angry at God. Because they see they're in the world and they're suffering and their material desires are not being fulfilled, and that they're actually angry at God for this. And probably, it's there in me. And that's one thing we have to get over also, to remember Krishna. To really understand who Krishna is, to really understand what is our relationship, to understand that at least the responsibility of coming to this world or turning away from Krishna, that belongs to us. And therefore the Vaishnava attitude is a humility that's not really comprehensible to a materialist. I cannot think of myself as anything but someone who turned away from Krishna. But a devotee, this spiritual humility is not a pathology. Because people always think that if you're humble, it's some form of low self-esteem. Low self-esteem is the conviction that I am not lovable. When a devotee actually discovers real humility, that's discovered in connection with the realization that whatever I've done, Krishna hasn't turned away from me. And that Krishna has love for me that is unconditional. Unconditional means no matter what. And that he sees something in me that maybe I don't see. And therefore the relationship with Krishna develops, the real me, what Krishna loves, starts to become manifest. So this humility is healthy. And these things, at least from my own experience, is necessary to go through in order to actually begin to remember Krishna always. Not to turn away from Krishna, not to look for substitutes in the fallible soldiers or in other things that are there. What the word here is gramya tasha. And this word gramya. Gramya means relating to a village. Villages have a bad reputation in the Bhagavata. Gramya sukham, village happiness for sense gratification. It means ordinary pleasures of material life. Gramya katha, pajalva, gramya katha. So there's the attachments to these material pleasures, which are really insignificant. But in a way, the problem with these pleasures is that they cause our ignorance, they cause our identification with the material body. Sense gratification has this inevitable aspect of increasing the identification with the material body and therefore forgetfulness of Krishna. Sense gratification is the act of appropriating things that belong to Krishna as mine. And in that act of appropriation, there's actually at the basis of it some hostility or avoidance to Krishna. So as attraction for Krishna increases, sense gratification decreases. So those people who have their future is not good, those who have invested everything in this material body. It's just a disaster. It's such a bad investment. Unfortunately, they don't know any alternative. But for a devotee, we know better. And with some practice of Krishna consciousness, in our case, is a very simple practice of remembering Krishna. As Krishna says in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he mentions this also, where he recommends remembering Krishna at the end of life. How do we do this? Abhyasa yoga yuktena, by abhyasa. The word abhyasa means practice, and practice means repetition. When you practice a musical instrument, you have to do it over every day. And that's what Prabhupada has given us, 16 rounds of chanting Hare Krishna, is practice. When Arjuna says, it's impossible to fix the mind on the Supreme because the mind is very turbulent, Krishna says, no, you can do it. And he says two things, abhyasa and vairagya. The same word, by practice. That is, we fix, in japa, we fix our mind on the holy name. When it starts to go away, the unfortunate tendency is we bring it back. Let us do this now while we still have some health. Right now I'm trying to chant the Hare Krishna mantra and there's some itch and I'm distracted. Some noise outside, I wonder what it is. Some thought should. Even now it's difficult. At the time of death, there's many distractions, and yet one has to remember Krishna. Of course, the fear factor may help us take shelter of him, but the practice is necessary at that time. So that's what he recommended by this abhyasa yoga yuktena, by practice of fixing the mind, as a simple thing, in a way, of fixing the mind, by chanting the holy name and bringing it back, we can begin to have actual experience of the self and actual realized spiritual knowledge. So if we do that in connection with studying Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, then we're on the way to real life. And one actually wakes up. People who are in denial about death, they've decided to become unconscious. Now, you cannot become selectively unconscious. So people who are in denial about death, they don't realize that they're missing out on life also. One last thing. Soldiers in battle sometimes report that they never felt so alive. It's paradoxical. It was a horrible situation. People are dying all around them, but they never felt so alive. And the reason is, in that situation, they've accepted death. They've already said, all right, I'm going to die. Death is all around me. This is what the world is like. I'm not in denial anymore. And suddenly, all their senses become, their consciousness becomes so alive. That's why also there's people who seek out these kinds of extreme experiences of confronting death, because then it makes them feel alive. This is their but you don't have to go anywhere. You can just sit right in this room and you actually can see what it's like. Prabhupada described Krishna consciousness as that one lives every moment with a thrill. because actually one is conscious, become more and more fully conscious. And there's the return of Sat, the return of Chit, and the return of Ananda, even though one is in this world. So that's what is being recommended here. And we should take this opportunity, not very many other people in Alachua County, to speak of the rest of the world, have this opportunity. Okay, thank you. Questions, comments? Yes, Prabhu.
The outside people also think that Krishna assumes the position of a narcissist.
Of a narcissist? Yes, he does.
Because he either you love him or he will put you in 8 million forms of spiritual life.
He will either you love him or, oh, I see, he makes you suffer. Yeah, I had one guy actually say that to me. That you know, what kind of a guy is Krishna? That okay, you don't want to be my servant, so now here's birth, death, old age, and disease. Why can't he give us, you know, eternal life full of bliss and knowledge, but no Krishna? If he was really generous, he would do that. It says like that. We are spiritual and Krishna is spiritual. And when we want to turn away from Krishna, we actually want to also turn away from ourselves. We want to be what we are not. We are devotees of Krishna, that's our constitutional position. So we want to be the opposite. So there's just certain things. Okay, you want not to be spiritual. You want not to be my servant. You want to be something you're not. Well, I'm going to have to provide you with a costume that's the not-self. And so here's this stuff called matter, which is actually a variation of spirit. It's another kind of spirit. But in this costume, you can forget me, since that's what you want to do. You can actually have to forget me means you have to forget reality. You want illusion. So he gives us this illusion. And so because it's the opposite, it has this character of Asad, Achit, and Nirananda. There are places that will come somewhat close to satisfying this desire in the material world. It's called the heavenly planets, where it seems like life is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, but not quite. Because as we know, there's trouble in paradise periodically. Come back down again. So there is a certain facility for that. But it's just logically what's necessary to be done to forget Krishna and to forget reality, and therefore you come into unreality. And in a way, Krishna hasn't punished us. We have punished ourselves. We've desired to forget him. We wanted this alternative. And so we have chosen it. Krishna wants us to come back to reality. He's always prompting us. He's come with us as the super soul. He's flooded the world with avatars and with devotees. And as soon as we turn toward him, he makes all arrangements. There's a limitation that Krishna has in this world, is that the limitation is imposed by our free will. So he doesn't coerce us back, but he can just attract us back. That's the limitation. Anything else? Yes?
I was talking to Dr. James Hall, the teacher's medicine, and I was explaining him that actually every living entity will live for love. Nobody can deny that.
Will live for love?
Yes. Whatever form, shape, that's a different question. Even the guy who was robbing bank in my street while I had a shop, when the interview came in the TV, just before he was taking to peace, and he said, "Oh, I just thought of robbing to pay the bill and then be peaceful."
Yeah, right.
So the ultimate issue, they will agree. Then Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that when the scholars, what to talk about common public, will identify Lord Chaitanya, what he has come to give, the wealth, they will embrace all the religion, all other religion will vanish. It's fair. Because I think in my way of seeing Prabhupada's teaching is so sweet that the food, the immortality that you have spoken very nicely, immortality or idealistic life, I think the full-fledged theistic life is exhibited by the Brajavasis in Vrindavan. That's how I see it from the lecture. And it is so harmonious, so lovable. They are not identified with the supreme or to pray, they bow down to me.
Yeah.
They are identified by the beauty.
That's
where everybody is looking for it. When I was explaining to Dr. James, he was so embracing, he was so much fascinated.
That's nice. Yeah. It's a fact, you know, that when I talk to people, I meet people and they say, well, I don't believe in God. And I say to them, well, why don't you describe to me the God you don't believe in? And I can always say, I don't believe in that God either. Let me tell you about Krishna. They always describe some nasty old man, you know. people don't understand. And that's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as you nicely said, has come to show us what Krishna is. Another thing you said about doing things for love, one year our temple kept getting broken in all the time. It was in December, and it's just one break-in after another. We kept calling the police, and they said, yeah, it's happening all over the neighborhood. I said, why all of a sudden? He says, well, it's Christmas time. And I realized it's for love. You know, they want to get their kids Christmas presents and things like that, so they have to go. And if you break in, and maybe you have a gun with you, you actually murder, you know, but it's for love. So your kid can get a Game Boy or something. I better stop now. Chaitanya has asked me to talk about one little thing about why I came here, what our little group has been doing. I'm part of a group that's called the Vedic Planetarium Cosmology Project. I'm actually the designated leader of this group. And the Vedic Planetarium Cosmology Project is the group that is supposed to figure out what's supposed to go in the Vedic Planetarium in Mayapur. I agreed to be part of this project last summer without knowing what I was getting into. And the person who has been carrying the ball on this one is a young lady named Charna Renu Devi Dasi, one of these other people that looks like a little kid, but she has a PhD in astrophysics. I'm the project leader, she's a coordinator. So we met in Mayapur and we looked at, outlined the whole gamut of research that's necessary to do. If you really want to do a first class, professional, respectable job of ascertaining the cosmology of the Bhagavatam and also be able to defend it against all comers. And it turns out it's an immense job, really, to do it really, really, really well. So we had a meeting. Now we have a committee that's the research committee that's supposed to, some of them do some research and other people just guide the research, because we had to farm this out to a lot of people. Because there's different aspects, there's the primary source research, that is to say, the Bhagavatam and all its commentators. Because Prabhupada translated, of course, the fifth canto, although he mentioned that there's a lot more to be done than what he was able to accomplish and wanted other people to go through it. So the fifth canto of Bhagavatam, that part, and all its commentators. Other Puranas, and they have commentators too. Upapuranic literature. There's cosmological material in the Ramayana, in the Mahabharata, in the Shrutis actually, the original Vedas. all that stuff needs to be gotten together, researched. We have to have looked at it all. Then of course there's this literature of scholars, academic scholars, both in India and the West, who have understood. And also in the primary material, there's the whole Siddhanta tradition, the Surya Siddhanta. There's five major Siddhantas. You can call them astronomical school, because it's based on observation and measurement, and they're like technical manuals. And these people have been debating with cosmological, Puranic cosmological people since at least the 8th century AD. We need to know about those debates, what was going on. So there's scholars who have already researched this. We have to know what all these scholars have said. If only to reject them, at least we have to have said we've looked at them. So there's that part of the research. Then there's the research of the fact that many things in the Bhagavatam are found in other archaic cultures. Sadhguru talks about some of this material in his books. That's a big field that needs to be researched further. And then, of course, there's the whole aspect of Vedic cosmology in relationship to modern astronomy and cosmology. So all these areas. So it's a huge project. And if you really want to do it correctly, you don't want to build something that's going to make you feel like idiots after 10 years and is going to uphold. So we've come up with a research plan for doing this on our committee. Is myself and Chandra Renu, Sadhaputta, Hridayananda Maharaj, Radhika Raman, Brahma Tirtha. That's what it is so far. And we came here because people are here in Alajua. So Ambarish Prabhu attended one of our first meetings to see what is going on. You may know something that they have to rethink the whole Mayapur temple right now because of land issues and the hostility of the government of West Bengal. May have to relocate where the temple will be and redesign it to fit the new location. So that's also going on at the same time. So we plan to, since we will have people working on this all over the world, we are making a website for researchers. Every text that we access, we will also scan and make it available to these other researchers electronically. All the bibliography will be posted. Researchers can talk to each other, and we will have a Wikipedia-style area where every, in an encyclopedia way, all different features and aspects of this will be placed, and others can contribute to until we gradually build up a body of knowledge so that many people can work at this from all over the world at one place at one time. So that website is almost ready to go online. And we will, in addition to the planetarium itself, there will be associated with it a research institute, because this is some things in that planetarium will be fairly permanent and other things will be updatable regularly, because this is the research. We will have a library there, and we want to make this a center where scholars all who want to study aspects of cosmology, Vedic cosmology, archaic cosmologies will come to Mayapur. Well, that's basically what the plan is. Okay? Any questions about that? Yeah?
What's the name of the website?
No, not yet. At first, it's just going to be for the researchers. Then parts of it will be made accessible to people in general. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Can I speak to Chris's aspect of helping Monica Shiva and some of his books up until now, somehow. Are you still into his books?
Huh?
Are you still into his books?
Yeah.